Welcome to Rethinking Trade with Lori Wallach, a podcast that unpacks international trade and how it affects you without putting you to sleep.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rethinking Trade with Lori Wallach. Today, we are going to do a deep dive on AI, artificial intelligence. Everyone is talking about it, but what is it really? And how could it affect you? And if you're wondering why the heck a podcast about trade and globalization is talking AI, dun, 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 the mystery will soon be revealed. We are very lucky to be joined today by Professor Suresh Venkatasubramanian. This is going to be part one of a two-part dive into AI. Professor Venkatasubramanian is now at Brown University, but this time last year, he was the assistant director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Also joining us as a special guest is my colleague and Rethink Trade's research director, Danielle Ronhell. Danielle, a trade lawyer, has just written a paper on how some of these policies about AI could get smacked into by so-called digital trade negotiations. And so he's going to join us as someone who knows a lot more than I do on AI in this conversation with Suresh. Because there's so much to cover, and we're super lucky to have Professor Venkatasubramanian with us, we're actually going to play out the entire conversation and split it into two episodes. It's fascinating. So make sure you stand by for part two coming next week. Just to start out, Suresh, for most of our listeners who certainly are not technologists, may I please ask you to just broadly share, what is AI?
Thanks, Lori. It's nice to be here and nice to meet you both. What is AI? It's a very interesting question because the answer keeps changing depending on who you ask and when. So let me give you the answer that most academics would give you. Most researchers working in AI would talk about AI as the discipline of trying to make systems, machines, that act like humans in different ways. That could mean reasoning like people do, like playing games, chess-playing programs, Go-playing programs, robots, your Roomba. It could mean seeing like humans, your computer vision systems. It could mean interacting and talking like humans, natural language processing, speech to text, and so on. So it's a whole collection of activities that reflect what we think of as intelligent human behavior. And that's important because what we think of as intelligent human behavior has also changed over time. And therefore, the field of artificial intelligence has also changed over time.
I'm wondering if you can explain to us a couple of places where already there's AI, because everyone's thinking AI is something in the future. But as your research on discrimination shows, there's a lot of automated decision-making that's affecting every one of our daily lives right now. What are some examples like that?
Yeah, I mean, so just in your own personal life, if you ever used Siri or Alexa or any kind of voice search, you're using some rudimentary forms of AI in the sense that you're talking to a computer system using natural spoken language and expecting it to understand or be able to process what you're asking it and give you answers. You know, Alexa, tell me what the temperature is today, and it'll give you an answer. So even in your home life, you use it all the time. You're using AI whenever you are doing a search or you're getting recommendations. Oh, what should I watch on Netflix tonight? And Netflix says, well, you know, you've watched some of these things in the past. You know, maybe you'd like this. That's using a rudimentary form of AI. It's a specific subfield of AI called machine learning, but we can talk about that in a bit. And more significantly and invisibly, when you apply for a loan, when you apply for a job, when you apply to college, and if you have to have a run-in with the law, or if you're, you know, walking through a busy city center and there are cameras surveilling you, in all of those situations, you are interacting with artificial intelligence or machine learning, which is, again, that subfield, whether you know it or not. And that's been going on for years.
And Suresh, I think that that's what has alerted a lot of people about the potential harms of AI. So could you explain a little bit more what scientists and researchers have found about the challenges or harms that AI is already causing in our lives?
One of the things that is helpful to keep in mind about the modern uses of AI, and I distinguish this from, say, early uses in the 60s and 70s, is that modern uses of AI are fundamentally learning from large amounts of data. That's why we often refer to the term as machine learning, the machines that learn. And so systems that learn from large amounts of data are trying to find patterns in the data that can be used to predict outcomes, predict what the system should say next, predict what the system should see, and so on. And once you recognize that these systems are being driven by large amounts of data, then the question becomes, how sensitive are these systems to the data that's being fed into them? What kind of skews or biases in the data could affect how the system produces its predictions? How unstable or how fragile is a system to variations in what kinds of data is provided? And that's when all the harms start becoming a bit more apparent. For example, if you're building a system to predict whether someone will do well in a particular job situation, in order to do this, you have to have prior examples of people who have been hired and have done well in that same situation. Otherwise, the system cannot, out of nowhere, come up with a prediction. It has to have prior data and find patterns in the data. So you have to collect data from people who've done well, which means you don't have data from people who you didn't hire. So if your system had biases in your prior system, even before using computers, had biases in how you were hiring people, all of those biases will transmit into how the system learns. And so that's one example of how biases in the way you have data, collect data, historical biases data, can be transmitted and amplified through these automated systems. Another problem is you might not have representative data. Maybe you have data from one population built in, I don't know, in California, but in San Francisco. And now you want to take this hiring system and apply it in Rhode Island, where I live. Will it work? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe the profile of population in Rhode Island is different. Maybe the characteristics of the population is different. Maybe that means that your predictions are not going to be accurate. And so that's another case where you have problems, when skews in the data can affect your results. There are also problems with the systems themselves, the way they're built. They're built to, you know, essentially pattern match, which means I give you a bunch of inputs and what the correct answer should have been in the past. And the system is supposed to be able to produce a new correct answer. It's like I give you a bunch of SAT tests with the answers filled out, and I want you to figure out, without understanding anything about math or English, how to give the correct answers. So you'll do some pattern matching on what you saw before and try to give the correct answer. And you'll do it by saying, what rule can I generate that would give me the most matching answers to what was given to me? So that's what the algorithm's trying to do, find the most matching answers. Well, that's great, and it's called accuracy, and you can improve the accuracy of a system. But it also means that if there's a significant chunk of the population, but not a big chunk, for which you give wrong answers, but you do really well on everyone else, your system will look really good. And suppose that small chunk of the population all comes from, say, one demographic group. So now you have a system that's systematically biased, it's systematically discriminating, just because it was told, look, just get as many good answers as you can. Don't worry about whether your answers are good answers are well distributed across different populations. So I could go on for a while, and you know, I'm a professor, so I tend to go on for a while, but I'll stop here. But these are just some of the examples of how, when you train these automated systems with large amounts of data to find patterns, you have very little control over what patterns are picked up, and it's often very hard to understand what those patterns are. And that's where you don't know how these systems are working, and more often than not, they make mistakes.
And we've seen those kinds of outcomes. There have been studies that show discriminatory outcomes in criminal sentencing that is based on AI, and housing decisions and loan decisions. So with all of that knowledge about the potential concerns, you were involved in a really important process in the Biden administration, which was creating a thing called the Blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights, which was published in October 2022. This was really the first time that the U.S. government had taken on broadly this set of AI issues and concerns. And I recommend actually for folks to read it. It's accessible. You can see it online, AI Bill of Rights. Can you describe for us sort of the crux of what, and it's a very long document, so this is an unfair question, but the crux of what the recommendations there were for how to proceed in a way that could get the benefits, but make sure to try and counter the downsides?
The reason why the term the Bill of Rights is in there is by inspiration with the original Bill of Rights, which is a set of rights protecting people from the oppressive power of the time, which was the government. The perhaps oppressive, perhaps not, but the big power of our time is technology, is the companies and the businesses and the states that use technology to govern our lives. And the blueprint is a recognition that we need protections for people in an increasingly algorithmically driven society so that we can get the benefits of technology, but not in a way that makes us subject to the tech, but makes the tech subject to what we want and what our aspirations are. And so the blueprint, while a long document, as you pointed out, is really five key principles. And when I tell you what they are, you're going to say, very natural, what's the big deal? And that's a good thing, by the way. And so what are they? Automated systems that we put out in the world that materially impact our lives. Right? So I'm not talking about, you know, a game that you might play that uses some AI, something that materially impacts your lives, should do five things. They should be safe and effective. They should not harm, and they should work at what they claim to do. You'd be surprised to know how many systems claim to do something and actually don't have no scientific basis for making that claim. So they should be safe and effective. They should not discriminate. We already talked about how systems can discriminate and how they should not. They should use our data judiciously and carefully. One of the sort of secondary and critical problems associated with needing lots and lots of data to do this kind of AI-based prediction is that there is a whole economy around collection of our data, widespread surveillance, careless use of our data in ways that leak our privacy in so many different ways. So systems should use our data judiciously and carefully. That's our three. Fourth one, these systems are often inscrutable and invisible. And you cannot reason about the safety of a system if you don't even know it exists and we don't know what it does. And as AI systems get more and more complex, this issue of do we even know how it works becomes even more critical. So systems should be visible and they should be explainable. We should have the right to know how a system is making a decision about us and why. And then finally, because all systems fail, you know, I'm very lucky that my audio is working today, but it might not. We need backups. We need human alternatives. We can't, if one system fails, we can't just send you to another system. I know many of you have probably had frustrations with calling a phone tree and saying, there's an automated system, say your request, and you see a request, and I have an accent, and it doesn't really register, right, and I do this over and over again. And at some point, you want to just break your cell phone because it's so frustrating. You need to have ways to talk to people. Because we are people, we're used to talking to other people, we have ways to communicate our needs. And you can't do that with an automated system. So safety and effectiveness, discrimination, judicious use of data, transparency, and human alternatives. That's what the blueprint is all about.
And what are some of the tools that you suggest in policy that can help deliver on those important goals?
So I like to think of this in terms of people, policy, and practices. Right, so, you know, and you have to cultivate all of them. It's an ecosystem of efforts where there is no one thing that's going to solve all the problems. So let's start with the most obvious ones. We need legislation. We need Congress and the states to act, to put into place protections for people along the lines of the blueprint would be my ideal choice. But frankly, any set of protections around transparency, around governance, around, you know, the limitations and careful scrutiny of how these systems are deployed, just like we do with drugs, with cars, with planes, with other consumer products. We need that. We need regulatory authorities. We need, you know, the FTC, the CFPB, the DOJ, other entities that are whose job is to regulate systems within their purview, the EEOC. We need them to be empowered to do the same thing for algorithmic systems. And a lot of these agencies are already looking very carefully into how the regulatory authorities would apply in the context of algorithms. And that's good too. We need better practices. We've talked about a lot, industry has talked a lot about voluntary practices. I think that's fine. I don't think it's enough, but I think it's an important part of this because you can't only force people to do things. You want people to adopt practices that make sense in their own context. And every context is slightly different. So I think if there are ways for industries, industry groups, you know, sectors to adopt practices and standards that make sense for them, you know, the risk management framework at NIST is another good example of this. That would be great. And I think we need that. And finally, we need, you know, people, we need education, we need training. And as a professor, I try to train my students, say, you know, here are the tools you can use when you go out in the industry. Here's the pieces of code you can play with to try and get a better sense of what the system is doing and how explainable it is and how to mitigate bias. We need all of that as well. So we need lots and lots of training so that we can change the culture around technology deployment away from a move fast and break things to a, you know, move carefully and be thoughtful. And that's very important as well, because fundamentally, in the long run, that's how we're going to affect real change.
Going back to the question of practices and what you mentioned about people needing protections, as a lawyer, whenever I hear that people have rights, then the other side of that coin is that someone has obligations. And what I'm getting from this is that developers have to have a set of obligations in order for people to enjoy those rights. And what was very interesting about the blueprint is that some of those obligations are already laid out there. We could see things like pre-deployment testing, independent evaluations, and also the need for developers to conduct algorithmic impact assessments. So I would love if you could explain a little bit more how those tools would be put in place and what we should expect.
One of the very strange and frustrating things I've seen about some of the reports, the journalism that has been done exposing the ways in which algorithms have been misused or have caused harm, is that the story will often go like this. There is this secret piece of software. It's used to decide who gets benefits. The system did not work, and a lot of people were harmed, and we did this discovery, and we got access to the code, and we did this detailed audit of the code, and here are all the problems. And so I'll talk about this in my classroom, and I'll say, you could have done all of this auditing and testing before you put the system out. You would have caught all the problems that the journalists caught, and no one would have been harmed because you would have found a way to fix those problems. And so to your point about expectations from and obligations of developers, doing an algorithmic impact assessment is something you can do right now. We just don't have a culture of checking these systems for these kinds of concerns before we put them out there. We're using people as guinea pigs to test our software. And then once people get harmed, and if we're lucky enough to have some exposure of the harms, then everyone says, oh, we should do something about this. So to your point about, you know, what the obligations are, what is an impact assessment? It's something as simple as, have you tested the way your algorithm behaves on different demographic groups? Like if you're worried about discrimination, right? Have you checked to see if your data set has any skews in it that might cause the algorithm to behave well on certain groups of people and badly on others? Have you looked at the model that is used to make the prediction and see if it's picking up on certain features of the data that it perhaps should not be picking up on? Have you tried to build it without those features so that it might not be discriminatory in the same way? Have you checked that the labels you're using, the pattern matching that your system is doing to find a model, to find a predictor, those labels are accurate for the task you really care about and not just some proxy that may not be? Things like this are almost like natural things to ask. And one of the things we lay out in our technical companion, what that makes the document so long, is to say, just do those things. Just ask. And the reaction I often get is, well, but that'll take time. And I'm like, yes, it will. That's the point. Take some time and look at it. There's no rush. If you're going to put out a system that affects millions of people's access to benefits, you don't need to be in a tearing hurry to do this.
Professor Venkata Subramanian's words seem like very prudent advice. on how we can demand that algorithmic transparency and accountability tools are put into place before AI systems are deployed into the world. Now, if you'd like to know how all of this intersects with trade policy, please stay tuned for part two of this series, which will be coming out in exactly 1 week. But for a preview, big tech lobbyists are trying to use their money and their power and cook up rules to jam into trade agreements that effectively would preempt policymakers here in the US, but also all around the world, from requiring companies to conduct their verifiable algorithmic impact assessments that the professor thinks are essential, as well as other things that were in the AI Bill of Rights that Professor Venkatasubramanian helped co-author, and that is the US policy about how to approach this issue. So, thank you for listening to this episode of Rethinking Trade, and please join us in 1 week for the rest of the story.